The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding, is now in session.
Please be seated. The first case for oral argument this morning is Terry Allsteel and Regional Health Physicians Appellants versus Stephen J. Whipp, Appellee. For the appellants, we have Mr. Jeffrey Hurd, a attorney from Rapid City, and for the appellee, we have Mr. Brad Lee, an attorney also from Rapid City. Gentlemen, have you been advised that the lights are not working? But the digital clock is, so go by the clock. All right. And I'll give you an oral signal in 2 minutes. With that, Mr. Hurd, you have 20 minutes, sir, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel. As indicated, my name is Jeff Hurd. I'm here on behalf of Dr. Terry Allsteel and Regional Health Physicians, the appellants in this matter. This appeal involves the privacy of non-party patient records and the security of patients in knowing that those records are going to remain private. The circuit court in this case has granted a motion to compel redacted non-party patient records, and we are asking this court to reverse that order of the circuit court. The primary question is whether or not redacting non-party patient records removes them from the purview of SDCL 19-19-503, the physician-patient privilege. This case arose because Dr. Allsteel operated on Mr. Whiff. Back in April of 2011, Mr. Whiff had a laparoscopic hernia repair, which is a procedure where you make two small incisions in his abdomen, you inflate the abdomen, and you actually do the surgery while watching on a screen. You do the surgery through those little holes using instruments that are inserted inside. That was on April 22nd of 2011. It's a same-day procedure. Mr. Whiff went home. The next day he came into Sturgis Hospital. I'm sorry, the procedure was performed up in Spearfish Regional Surgery Center. The next day he went into the Sturgis Hospital complaining of pain. He was seen by the emergency room physician, sent home with additional instructions and pain medications. He came back on the 26th then of April. He was kept overnight for observation. They did a CAT scan and found that he had a large abscess and fistula. And he was transported down to Rapid City Regional Hospital, where they actually opened him up and performed a procedure to take care of the abscess and the fistula, and they found two small perforations in his bowel. So the case here, the issue here, is whether or not Dr. Allsteel nicked the bowel. Is he the one who actually caused that problem during his initial surgery? Everybody agrees that's not necessarily malpractice. It is malpractice to do that and not find it, to not look for it and not find it. And so that's where the real issue turned. The expert for the defense testified, and his opinion is, you couldn't have found any perforations of the bowel at the time of the surgery because it didn't exist at that time. And we know it didn't exist at that time because if it had, he would have been much sicker much earlier than he was. These perforations opened up or formed, became what they call frank perforations, sometime after Dr. Allsteel's surgery. Well, during the expert's deposition, he was asked over objection, when can you hold a doctor legally responsible for his care? And he essentially said, well, you have to find the doctor's not competent. We all know that's wrong. The doctor simply answered legally wrong. But then he was asked again over objection, how would we determine that? And his testimony was, well, you'd look at what he called the batting average, the physician's history of complications in these types of procedures. Based on that testimony, Mr. Whiff asked for all of the medical records for Dr. Allsteel's procedures over a certain period of time and agreed that they could be redacted.
Was the purpose of the motion based on this batting average theory?
It is based on the batting average theory. That was the main point. There's a secondary point as well, and that's this. Previously, Dr. Allsteel was asked, and this is a perfectly legitimate question, Dr. Allsteel was asked whether or not he had had other bowel perforations. He knows of two that he had. Both of them are plaintiffs in cases represented by Mr. Lee. He's performed about 900 of these laparoscopic hernia repairs, and over that time, he's only aware of these two cases. The problem is those two cases came within just a few months of one another in 2011.
Well, is this expert going to testify at trial?
He is.
And he's still going to opine that there was no negligence here?
He's still going to opine that the records indicate, my hope is he'll stop using the word negligence, but he is going to opine that the procedure was done properly and that the medical history following the procedure demonstrates that there was no bowel perforation at the time Dr. Allsteel closed up.
But isn't the plaintiff entitled to attempt to impeach his opinion, whatever it might be, based on his deposition testimony?
We don't believe so, Your Honor, because we don't believe the expert has the ability to make an error that changes the standard of care. Dr. Allsteel's complication rate is not relevant to the question of whether or not his care in this particular case was appropriate. So it will be our position in a motion in limine that he cannot be asked that question.
Okay, maybe this is a rabbit hole that we're going down here, because this appeal really doesn't question relevancy, does it? We're just looking strictly at the privilege question and the meaning of the statute. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. The relevance is always kind of an issue here, because why you want it is always an issue when we're looking at evidentiary questions, but we have not appealed the relevance determination or the burdensome determination. Those are so well within the purview of the trial court that the standard on that doesn't seem to warrant review. In this case, the question is going to be, just as you said, Justice Zinter, what does 1919-503 mean? South Dakota has no common law privileges. If you're going to find an evidentiary privilege, you have to find it in the code, number one. Number two, where the language of a statute is clear, the inquiry ends. We believe that 1919-503 clearly says that a patient has the right to refuse to disclose and to prevent anyone else from disclosing their confidential medical information. Further, under subpart C of that statute, the doctor has the ability to exercise, to assert that privilege on behalf of the patient. We believe that is clear, and because that is clear, that should end the inquiry.
Has there been any attempt in this litigation to notify these other patients that their records may be subject to inspection?
There have not.
All right.
Subpart D provides the exceptions, and redaction is not one of the exceptions in subpart D of 1919-503. So we believe that that ends it. The trial court did not express an opinion as to why she entered the order that she entered, but plaintiff, Mr. Wiff, relied on several cases where courts had held that redaction removes the records from the privilege. The most famous of those cases, most highly cited of those cases, is a case called Rudnick out of California, and that kind of started the whole idea. But again, we don't believe you get there, because those courts which have said it doesn't apply, several cited in the brief, if you look at Parkson versus Central DuPage Hospital, what they say is you look at the statute. The statute doesn't contain an exception for redaction. Therefore, you apply the statute. Redaction doesn't apply. Roe versus Planned Parenthood of Southwest Ohio, I thought, made a really good point, and that is redaction misses the whole point. Redaction is how you protect information within a discoverable record that otherwise should not be discoverable. And a classic case of that is this case's decision in Maynard versus Harine. Had the plaintiff waived the privilege to those records? Absolutely. Plaintiff's psychiatric health was in issue. It was an emotional distress claim. But this court said, But just because it can come in doesn't lower its sensitivity. And so we are going to make sure that the trial court reviews these in camera and redacts out those things which should not be relevant. That's the role of redaction, not to take privileged documents and make them unprivileged, but to protect otherwise sensitive information within documents that are not privileged.
You know, these cases always come down to, but not always, but we're always talking about majority-minority rules. I see you're relying on Ohio, Texas, and Illinois. The other side says they have the majority, and numerically they certainly do. How do you address that?
Numerically, they certainly do. I address it by saying South Dakota is different for two reasons. Everyone here agrees that the purpose of this statute is to increase the confidence in patients that their medical information is confidential. That is to encourage candor, to encourage them to be forthright in talking to their doctors. That, in turn, is to improve healthcare. Everybody agrees that's the purpose. This court, in Hogue versus Massa, this court said that unlike all other privileges, the physician-patient privilege should be liberally construed to broaden protections under the privilege for the purpose of advancing that role. When you look at the cases where redaction has been held to remove documents from the purview of the privilege, almost all of them would not work in South Dakota. There is the Staley case out of Utah, where the Staley court specifically said, we're going to allow that because they're seeking the documents of six patients in an area that has multiple hospitals, 900,000 people. There is no way to back up from these redacted records, which were nothing but the vitals taken by one nurse of six patients on one floor. Here they're asking for, let me give a little context. In 2011, five surgeons provided care in Spearfish. Of those, only four of them regularly did. One of them was a physician from Rapid City who would occasionally travel up there. Dr. Allsteel provided most of those cases. If all of his patients who had hernia repairs know that Mr. Lee and his client, other patients, have access to their records, that's a far different cry from the cases the plaintiff relies upon. This whole area kind of started with the Rudnick decision. Rudnick was a case where a drug manufacturer was sued to get drug interaction reports that had been sent in from all over the country in this particular use of this drug. What this court decides is going to decide whether or not patients in Tyndall get their medical records disclosed as long as they are redacted. And two things. I think most of the courts that have addressed this have said, who have denied it, have said statute doesn't permit it, QED, end of proof, that's all we need to know. Those that have gone to the purpose of it have all said that it is critical that you never be able to identify the patient. If there is a risk of that, then it should not be allowed. In South Dakota, because of the Hogue versus Massa decision expanding the privilege, and because of our small rural system, the care we have here, those burdens, we believe, are simply not worth the risk, and there's no exception for them provided in the statute. We do not recognize common law privileges, therefore the statute controls. And finally, I think that I've only seen this in one case, but it made a lot of sense to me, and that's the Northwest Memorial Hospital case. Judge Posner says, look, it doesn't matter whether they can be identified. What matters is whether or not patients are going to feel like their privacy has been betrayed when they learn of this. If the Rapid City Journal says all Dr. Allsteel's surgeries have been disclosed to a plaintiff's law firm and his client and his expert, if you are one of those patients living in Spearfish, what's your reaction? If you are a patient who hasn't even gone to see Dr. Allsteel yet, or anyone else, does it, will that change what you say? When you know that your records can be provided to others outside of the system. Okay. And I think Judge Posner makes a good point. It shouldn't be allowed whether anybody ever figures out who these patients are or not, because of the effect it has on the view, the confidence of the patient. And I think that what makes that even more critical is how that ties directly to the purpose of the privilege, right? The purpose of the privilege is to increase confidence in the privacy of these records, to increase candor, to increase the quality of the care. Anything that we do that undermines that.
If that's true, then how do we get, if the privilege is that absolute, how do we get by credentialing and peer review? Because those records are looked at by others that have not been consented to in those situations.
Yeah. I would answer it this way. Number one, 1919-503 only applies to actions in court, not to peer review. 1919-101, which sets the scope of the rules of evidence, says it applies to court proceedings. There are
You're saying the privilege doesn't apply if it's a non-court proceeding?
What I'm saying is that there are other... No, I'm saying that particular rule of law would not necessarily apply. 36-430, I believe it's sub 4, makes it actionable against a doctor's license for disclosing other medical information outside of a confidential relationship. And then, of course, we have the healthcare Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996, HIPAA, which regulates the use and disclosure of healthcare information. But in terms of credentialing, when I'm not aware of a single case anywhere in the country where a court has held that the evidentiary physician-patient privilege prohibits the use of medical records within the credentialing and peer review process. 36.4.26.1 makes all of those records and all of that information hyper-protected. I see that argument, and I understand that Mr. Whiff has made that argument, but I see that argument as one lacking any support anywhere else in the country. I've never seen a case that says that. But I also believe that if you go to the underlying, the whole point again is to improve health care. That's why 36.4.26.1 exists. That's why HIPAA permits medical records to be used and disclosed for peer review and credentialing purposes. And I don't believe that a decision in this court saying that you may not compel non-party patient records to a private litigant will have any effect or can have any effect on the peer review and credentialing procedures. So I think...
statute has to mean something different in that situation.
No, what I'm saying is that because 1919-101 says these rules of evidence apply in court proceedings, that 1919-503 does not on its face apply to peer review and shouldn't be applied to peer review because there are other statutes, specifically 36.4.26.1 and 36.4.30 sub 4, that specifically address that issue.
Yeah, a little less than 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. But I think we're on to this topic is important, and that is what is the practical effect of these rulings. If the court determines that redaction removes non-party patient records from the purview of the physician-patient privilege, where does disclosure end? I mean, Dr. Alstiel will have to be allowed to explain why these non-party records are the way they are. He'll have to be able to explain what care was provided and why, which necessarily expands the amount of information that has to be disclosed. Two, you've also got the burden and the cost. cited in my brief, as one commentator said, as a practical matter, to try to redact all of these records, it's almost easier to try to get all of the patients permission to use their records. It would be a very onerous and expensive process, particularly where there isn't any fundamental reason that's been set forth by the plaintiff that this wouldn't apply in every case. If redaction removes the protection, then all we need to show is relevance, and we can get all of the medical records of all non-parties simply by suitable redaction. The practical effect would be unwieldy, and I don't believe we can get our arms around it, but more to the point, it would fundamentally undermine the confidence of the people of South Dakota in the privacy of their records. And having undermined that confidence, we've undermined the entire purpose of the privilege, which is to improve health care through increased candor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hurd. Mr. Lee, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and good morning. On behalf of Steve Whipp, we would ask that you affirm the lower court's determination that the disclosure of redacted non-party medical records does not violate the patient-physician privilege because, first and foremost, the purpose of the privilege is not violated. If we were to adopt the three arguments proposed by the appellant in this case, we would have an unreasonable interpretation of our statute that violates public policy. The clear majority of the courts hold that redaction is sufficient to get these records outside of the privileged statutes that these states have. And further, HIPAA holds that if you don't identify who the patient is, there's no privilege violation. We talked a lot about the purpose in our briefs, and we heard Mr. Hurd talk about that. And I want to read it so we see exactly what it says. And it's in People and Interest of DK. The physician-patient privilege expresses a long-standing policy to encourage uninhibited communication between a physician and his patient. It is a privilege that seeks to ensure the free flow of health care. Absent any fears on the patient's part that anything he says might later be used against him. Why is that significant? Nothing in our purpose statute that we've interpreted says it's designed to keep other people from looking at our medical records. And how does that correlate with the cases cited by the defendant? Columbia Valley, the Texas case that we referenced just a little bit ago, it's specifically noted in there that the purpose in Texas of its privilege statute is to prevent unnecessary disclosure of highly personal information. That's on page 801 of that case. So here in South Dakota, the purposes of our statute is to protect the patients from having the information they give to their doctor be used against them. That's not going to happen in this case. They're not alleging it. We're not going to do it. The point is not to use anything against these patients. It's to hold a doctor accountable for severely injuring Mr. Whipp and killing Betty Bolstead. The Columbia Valley case is distinguishable for that fact alone and other facts. We look at the construction. We look at the plain meaning of the statute, but we also have to
go back. You're saying used against them. Are you saying only in a criminal context? Are you saying in a civil context? Are you saying to embarrass them? How are you saying those words should be interpreted?
I think according to how our court has interpreted the statute, it's broadly interpreted, and I'd use it as anyway, in any manner, criminally, civilly, to try and embarrass or use it against them. And I think that I agree with you, Justice Severson. You could make that argument that if it's being used to embarrass these patients, then that would violate the statute. But again, that is not the purpose why these documents are being sought in this case.
Well, if it's the purpose or not, it could do so if it was personal information that is released, could it not?
Not with the safeguards that we would have in effect as adopted by HIPAA and the majority of
courts.
Well,
HIPAA doesn't apply. This is a state court proceeding. Isn't it?
True, to a certain extent, Your Honor. I think, and the reason why I bring that up is I reference back to page 14 of the appellant's brief. They specifically reference that. And they note the importance of the privileges. And it's talk about how the American Medical Association's principle of medical ethics talks about the purposes of these privileges. And it was so important, they codified it in federal law under HIPAA. And based on HIPAA, then we have a set of factors that explains what needs to be done to carry out the effect of the American Medical Association's Code of Ethics. So technically, as a state, do we have to do it when we're in a state court proceeding, not applying federal law? No, I think it's correct that we don't have to. Courts have said that there is a suppression issue clause. Other courts in my brief, I've noted, have said it's not. But I think the American Medical Association's reference to HIPAA is very good guidance for this court, that if it's good enough for the federal courts and the nation, it's good enough for South Dakota to follow to get the uniformity that citizens, I think, deserve to have. We talk about the construction. Again, we interpret this and assume the legislature did not want an absurd result. And we talked a little bit about earlier with Mr. Hurd about the certification procedure. And I laid those examples out. If this statute is as strictly construed as the defendants would like in this case, it would lead to not only an absurd interpretation, but a violation of public policy. For example, how would anybody...
Well, public policy does trump the exact wording of a statute, does it?
No, but I think it adds to our interpretation of the statute as to whether the definition, the reasoning adopted by one party is reasonable or not. And here we have a situation where I referenced bad faith cases stemming from workers' compensation proceedings. Routinely, we have discovery of pattern and practice evidence that involves the disclosure of other claims files to show that an insurer has a pattern of practice of violating the law. In those claims files, we get the medical records of these other claimants. It's redacted. Mr. Hurd tried to distinguish the Burke case and the Ridco case, the Ridco or Andrews versus Ridco. That's our case. That's
but
the information in, that's in it.
In insurance litigation, you don't have a provision like 503B, do you?
According to the interpretation that's being advocated by Mr. Hurd, yes. I interpret it based on his brief that this is an absolute privilege and that unless there's a specific express waiver or one of these enumerated exceptions apply, then you cannot get this information, and it's a violation of that patient's privileges. We look at another reasonableness. There's a judge who talked about it in Resilin. Imagine taking a medical record, intake sheet, and you redact absolutely everything off it except the word cough. According to the interpretation provided by Allsteel, that would be a violation of that patient's privileges and a violation of 503. And I think that goes with our argument. It doesn't make sense, and it doesn't seem reasonable. In the reply brief, Mr. Hurd tried to explain that what his expert was doing was really talking about the what needed to be proved in a negligent credentialing case. Maybe that is true. But then let's look at that. How would a plaintiff ever prove that a hospital negligently credentialed a doctor if they could never discover any of the other treatment cases it's had or all the other medical records? That cause of action, you'd be unable to prove it. What about cases where we're trying to prove that a doctor committed medical fraud by overbilling patients for treatment or unnecessary procedures? According to the defendant's adoption, there's no exception for that. Those records are immune from discovery. What we have here is a majority of cases that have addressed this. And they've explained that if you do not disclose the identity of the patient, there's no violation of the privilege. And how do we do that? We do it through redacting it. We do it through protective orders. We do it through orders by the court to counsel saying, you may not try and contact these non-party patients to discover their identities. That's exactly what we've agreed to do. And although Judge Percy's order was not as detailed as I think we would like it to be at this point, it's understandable because we didn't present the type of arguments to Judge Percy at the time that we're presenting in detail right now.
You know, that brings up a good point. It looks to me like the cases that you rely on, the trial court took a much more detailed look at the time of the order with respect to privacy, how much redaction might be necessary because of the size of the community. Does a protective order need to be placed on counsel and the expert? And it doesn't look to me like Judge Percy did any of that in this case. Does the case at least need to be remanded for that purpose?
I don't think so, Justice Zinter. And I agree with you. There wasn't this argument to Judge Percy that the area in which we live is too small to even allow this to happen, because I don't think those cases that I rely on really require that when I look them over. I don't think that's the primary turning point. I know the Staley Court, which Mr. Hurd cited, talks about that, but I don't believe the majority of the cases cited in my brief or the string cite really go into great detail regarding that. And I think, regardless of the fact, I believe if you redact the records pursuant to what HIPAA requests, have an order in place for attorneys as officers of the court not to try and seek out the identity of these people, plus we have a protective order in place, I think we're going to be okay.
But none of that was done in this case. Doesn't it at least need to be remanded for that purpose?
I think in this situation, Judge Percy did decide in her order what should be redacted. Did it go as far as HIPAA states? No. I think that's because we didn't have the guidance from this court on where to go with that. But what I would ask this court to do is, if they do remand it, to affirm, but also to remand and say, we want all the information set forth in HIPAA to be redacted from these records, and then the court needs to have a determination whether a protective order is necessary, and also whether there needs to be a supplemental order to the attorneys to not specifically contact the non-parties or try to discern their identity. And you can even go so far as to hold documents under seal. But I think those four provisions will protect us from any possible disclosure. I mean, look at us. We handle cases all the time where we're dealing with minors, trade secrets, confidentiality clauses. These protections we have in place work. And that's why these states have adopted them and have been following them for so many years. One of the concerns in the reply brief was that, you know, the Rudnick case was really not quite on point factually, and the Henry Reslin case was not exactly on point, as cited in my brief. Well, if you note, there was a whole string of cases I cited underneath there, and I didn't want to go into great detail, but I talked about Rudnick because it was, like Mr. Hurd said, the beginning of this. And the reason I cited Henry Reslin is because it's multi-district litigation in a federal court setting. They went into great detail explaining the holding, and it was one of the most recent cases. But if you look at the first four cases cited in that string cite on page 12 of my brief, Bennett, Ziegler, Community Hospital Association, and Ventimiglia, all those cases are medical malpractice cases where the courts have permitted discovery of non-party patients and explained that it can be accomplished through redaction and a protective order and even orders to the attorneys not to contact the parties or try and discern their identity. We talked a little bit about the Columbia Valley case. Justice Zinter, I think you talked about how the minority was these three cases. Quite frankly, I think there's only two. I think Texas, the opinion in Columbia Valley, it's a Court of Appeals opinion. As I said before, there's a difference in Texas's law. But Henry Reslin was decided after that, and they were called on to determine what Texas would decide if they were presented with this decision, the Texas Supreme Court, and they disagreed with Columbia Valley. And they said, we believe that if the Texas Supreme Court were to address this issue, they would agree with the majority of the courts that this is not privileged information when you redact the identity of the party. Northwestern Memorial Hospital, Mr. Hurd talked about that. Northwestern and Memorial and Roe v. Planned Parenthood are different. And it's primarily, I think, because in the factual situation, they're dealing with such a private nature. We're dealing with abortion. In fact, in Northwestern Memorial, it wasn't necessarily a discovery order. It was a subpoena by the government, and it was a motion to quash. And so a lot of the determination in that case was regarding the relevance and the undue burden of producing that information. Northwest Memorial dealt with the propriety of a doctor taking babies out and doing partial birth abortions when their bottom half of their body was out versus just dissecting the baby in the womb. That's a different animal than a laparoscopic hernia repair surgery. And if you,
it certainly is, but they're all medical procedures. We're talking about a medical privilege statute. I don't know how you can differentiate that.
I point it out just to show factually it's different. And when you look at Northwestern, the vast majority of that case talks about why the information is not relevant, and that's why they determined to quash the information. The last paragraph is really where they only talk about the fact, and by the way, Illinois is of the opinion that this information is always privileged regarding redaction, so we're going to quash the motion or the subpoena in this case. So again, Northwest Memorial really dealt with a weighing of the relevance versus the burden. And in Northwest Mutual, the government in that case indicated that they were not foreclosing the opportunity to go contact these other ladies who had abortions to try and talk to them about it. So again, huge difference in that case between ours. We're not going to contact these non-party patients. In that case, the government said they would. And further, they couldn't explain why it was relevant. So, and again, we talked a little bit, Mr. Hurd did, about the relevance and the burden towards the end of his argument. If you note on page 3 of his brief, they didn't appeal that. They didn't appeal that the trial court determined this information was relevant and that it was not an undue burden. So that's not really an issue for us here today.
How will this evidence, if it's produced, be used at trial? Or if it's not produced, how will that affect the trial?
Well, if it is produced at trial, I mean, first we'd have to see if it's relevant. I think the first thing we would look at, Justice Kern, is that in this case, from the outset, we've asked Dr. Allsteel to explain to us in interrogatories. You denied you cut the bowel. Explain why. He wouldn't do it. He refused. It wasn't until his expert came up with a theory that what they think happened is he did the procedure, sewed up the patients, or the patient in this case, Mr. Whip, and then spontaneously these holes erupted in the bowel. One, we're going to try and elicit this information to show that this was not just a one-time deal. And it wasn't, because we know 4 months later the same thing happened to Betty Bolstead and she passed away. But Dr. Allsteel is claiming that these are the only two times that anything bad has happened in his procedures, and we should have the opportunity to get the records to show whether that's accurate or not. I relate it to a personal injury case. Imagine as a defense attorney, you get interrogatory answers, have you ever had a prior back injury? Nope, I was always in good health. Well, now could you imagine us saying, well, you can't have the prior medical records because we told you that there hasn't been a problem. That would never happen. I trust that Dr. Allsteel testified truthfully, but I'd like to verify that with the records to make sure that's accurate.
Well, isn't that analogy really doesn't fit, because you're talking about the same person. This is a third person that you're talking about, not the person who had the back injury. Obviously, that would be admissible.
Sure. You're right, Justice Stevenson, but for purposes of impeaching Dr. Allsteel and explaining that his testimony that this has never happened before is not correct, that's why we're bringing it in.
Right, but you're dragging other people into it. That's the point. That's the purpose of the privilege.
Sure, but we are not dragging other people into it. Those people will never be called to testify. We will never know their identity. That information will always be privileged and protected pursuant to the court, and that's why it's set out in HIPAA, and in other states, the procedures we go through to ensure that those protections are in place. The other case that was discussed was Roe v. Planned Parenthood, and again, that was another significant case in that involved a 13-year-old girl who was raped by her soccer coach, convinced to have an abortion, and then forced to keep it secret. As I read Roe versus Planned Parenthood, it wasn't necessarily a long discussion, in my opinion, regarding whether information should be disclosed or not, but more was a determination where they just said this should be decided by the legislature. But if you look at the dissent in that case, it's by Justice Donovan, and I think it fits aptly.
Yes, 2 minutes.
Thank you. I think it fits aptly in what we're dealing with here. And the two phrases he states, I want to quote. He says, "The privilege should terminate where the public peril begins. Whether uncovered by an individual plaintiff, class of plaintiffs, prosecuting attorney, or attorney general, the privilege should be construed narrowly because it is in derogation of the search for the truth. Lost in all the debate is the fact that the confidentiality of patient records is for the protection of the patient, not the physician. The defendants should not be permitted to frustrate a civil suit, questioning their professional conduct, or lack thereof, by asserting the physician-patient relationship. And as I mentioned in the brief, this is really what we're here about. We're not here because we're trying to protect people that have had surgery by Dr. Allsteel from being discovered. We're here because Dr. Allsteel wants to protect that information from being disclosed so it can't be used against him in this medical malpractice lawsuit. Unless there are further questions, I would return the rest of my time to the court.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lee. Mr. Hurd, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Let's begin where we just ended. The dissent in a case from another state says that this should be construed, the privilege should be construed narrowly. That is not the law of South Dakota. The law of South Dakota, as set forth in Hogue versus Massa, is exactly the opposite. In South Dakota, the physician-patient privilege is the one evidentiary privilege which is to be read broadly and liberally to enhance the protections of medical information.
How would you respond to his interpretation of 503B that it only applies to confidential communications and not the balance of the medical file?
This case in the I should have grabbed it. It's in my brief. We have this court has previously held that that privilege, which is the same as it was when it was under Rule 37, that privilege applies to all medical records, not necessarily just communications. This court's already decided that. I want to say it's either Magbahut or Martin Moss, but it is cited in my brief. It applies to all medical records, and I've never seen a court that ruled that medical records in general are not subject to the physician-patient privilege unless they evidence some direct communication between a physician and a patient. Kind of going back to the way Mr. Lee began, he said that the purpose of the privilege is not privacy, but to prevent self-incrimination. That is not the purpose of this privilege. No court has ever held that that's the purpose of this privilege. If that were true, why redact at all? Use immunity could meet the privilege's purposes just as easily as redaction if that were its only purpose. Justice Inter, I agree. We don't believe a protective order applies because we believe it is privileged. And protective orders are not used to remove the privilege from privileged documents, but to protect the dissemination of information which is otherwise discoverable. But should the court determine that there is no privilege for redacted non-party patient records, the court would still have to remand this order for consideration of an appropriate protective order. I'm not sure the specific public policy that Mr. Lee was talking about. He gave a few examples, but I don't see a common policy among any of them. On the bad faith cases, I'll have to take his word for it. He said that was his case, and there were medical records in it. Wasn't my case, and the opinion says absolutely nothing about medical records. The opinion says absolutely nothing about the physician-patient privilege. I can't speak to what the underlying lawyers did in that case, but there's no precedential authority from those cases relating to bad faith. The argument that it would apply even if we were going to redact everything but the word cough, number one, I don't believe there would be any relevance left. We could do that statistically. But number two, the circuit court has ordered us to produce every record for every patient from the date of surgery extending out another 30 days. That is not analogous to removing every word from a record except the word cough.
When we're talking about records, are we talking about fourth-party record, hospital records, or are we talking about the doctor's office records? When I read the order, I couldn't determine that.
You can't from reading the order. Regional health physicians is part of regional health. So generally, you know, the general discovery rule is I have to produce not only what I have, but what I have the power to get. And we agree that regional health physicians has the power to get other documents from within the regional health system. So it would include all the hospital records and clinic records from Dr. Oldsteel.
Would that make it, well, if we decide this, we are going to decide this issue, but is it going to then affect other situations where it's not, I'm hearing you to say this is an incorporated physician group. What if it's not? What if it's an independent hospital and physician?
Then the same rule, I'm assuming, the same rule would apply if they had served it by subpoena as it does by serving it as a request for production of documents. So evidentiary privileges are going to apply the same way in either direction because the holder of the privilege are all of these patients in Spearfish who don't know anything about this. They're the holders of the privilege. No one in this courtroom today is the holder of the privilege on the documents we're arguing over. They're people who aren't going to know that their records have been implicated until they read about it in the Rapid City Journal. So I wouldn't see any difference as to whether it was served by subpoena or discovery request. Theoretically, if they could come up with a list of patients, they could serve the patients themselves with it. The only other, and I would also say this, the statistical information was provided. It isn't just Dr. Altsteel's testimony. We can search by procedure code, laparoscopic hernia repair, and we can take that body and search again by bowel perforation types complications, complication rates. We provided that information to plaintiff's counsel. That's not privileged. We ran the searches. We could only find, actually one of the two came up, the other one we knew about from a different procedure, because when you cross hospitals, you lose some of that data. But the statistical information would always be available. So when we're talking about the negligent credentialing situations, healthcare fraud situations, those statistical information is available. We can get that information, and we can produce that without producing the actual records.
I think Mr. Lee's point is that he wants to be able to verify the accuracy of the documents that you rely upon to calculate your complication rate.
True. And I can understand that. At some level, that would become a burden issue. But the other problem with it is, and it's not unique to this case, discovery among officers of the court requires a certain amount of trust. If someone is going to provide an answer to an interrogatory that says there are two cases, and I'm going to lie about it, there's no reason that I also would not just fail to produce the records that would otherwise show I had lied about it the first time. We rely upon one another's good faith and honesty as officers of the court. Frankly, I've been doing this since 1990, and I can count on far less than one hand the number of times I've been disappointed in the honesty of South Dakota lawyers and practitioners in that regard. But I understand that he wants to be able to verify it. That goes to relevancy. And as I said, we're not appealing the court's relevancy determination on an interlocutory matter, because I just find that is just so soundly within the purview of a trial court that it would be difficult to do.
2 minutes.
The purpose of the privilege is not self-incrimination. The purpose of the privilege is to improve healthcare, walking it backwards, to improve healthcare by increasing patient candor through increasing the confidence of people that they can be honest with their doctors and their health information will be kept private. The law says that these 1919-503 says that the patient has the right to refuse to produce this information and to prevent anyone else from producing this information. And Dr. Altsteel, regional health physicians, are asserting the right on behalf of those non-party patients to protect those records. We ask this court to reverse the circuit court's order granting the motion to compel. And we thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hurd. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.